United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Why is Ukraine so important to us here in the United States? Hello, I'm Jerry Christensen, and this is the Seminary Explores. Our guest is Mr. Dennis Carter, who is a retired Foreign Service officer, and I'm going to tell you his career, even though it takes a little time, because we'll want to know exactly where he's coming from. He served with the Department of State from 1978 until 2001, and in his 23-year diplomatic career, he worked in six different countries: Kuwait, Peru, France, Jordan, the United Kingdom, and Grenada. After retiring in 2001, he continued to serve the department as a reserve officer, instructing at the Foreign Service Institute and as a contract employee. His career over this 38-year period has taken him to more than 40 countries, but he's a homegrown boy, born in Altoona and a 1974 graduate of Penn State University. Why, Dennis, is Ukraine so important to us? What is their economy? Where are they and what is their economy? Sometimes people don't even know where Ukraine is.
Well, Ukraine's just north of the Black Sea, south of Belarus and Russia. It's east of Austria, Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, now the Slovak Republic. And the Black Sea is on the south. It's bordered by no natural boundaries except maybe the Carpathian Mountains. So it's always been the focus of grasping empires because it's a rich agricultural land primarily. It's also a dynamo, an industrial dynamo, and has the potential to be a major economic power. Particularly since it's independent now, they've made great strides to develop their export markets, bring their economy into sync with modern finance, moving away from a command economy into a free market economy has been their goal, and that's largely why the population and now the government is gravitating toward the economic the European Union, economic integration with the European Union.
So we were squeezed between Poland and Russia. There aren't many natural boundaries east or west, and so everybody's been there to try to grab it or grab parts of it. As a medieval historian myself, I know that the conflict over Ukraine has been extensive for centuries, including attempts to grab its great resource in the Middle Ages, and that's agriculture. It was the breadbasket of Europe for years. Vast acres of agriculture. That's wonderful black soil.
Well, it's the soil, and it's that covers about two-thirds of the country from all the research that I've done preparing. Back 1,000 years, several empires. Here's one that you don't hear of very often: the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, and then a Polish-Lithuanian Union in the Middle Ages. The Polish nobility moved in and brought Polish colonists, who then they abused for centuries. There was in the East the Golden Horde.
Yes.
They came in and
Out of Mongolia.
And one of their economic activities was actually what they called harvesting the steppe, where they gathered up millions, literally millions. I see the number 2 million slaves from Russia and Ukraine were taken from the steppe and basically directed toward the Turkish market, which apparently over centuries was insatiable for slaves.
And we get the name slave from Slav, don't we? At least it's thought we do.
Well, you're the medieval historian.
So. I will say with great firmness, we get the name slave from the fact that so long the slaves were taken from Slavic countries, including Ukraine.
And of course, the Kievan Rus, who founded Ukraine in around the year 1000, were part and parcel of that slave trade as well.
Well, we mentioned somewhere that they came out of the great north of Scandinavia. They were Vikings, and they too went in the slave trade.
I'm sure your interest is to mention
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Also from the east, there was a Khanate that formed in Crimea, which gives us a sort of a focus on the very fascinating and distinct history of Crimea. And I think we want to talk about that when we get to
one
the more modern
conflict,
era,
yes.
A little later. So the history, it's been fought. Ukraine has been fought over for 1,000 years, and it's apparent that fighting's not over yet.
If we could fast forward to recent history, when did Lithuania finally become? I'm sorry. When did Ukraine finally achieve its so-called independence?
Well, there's no living memory of this now, but it was briefly independent after the First World War. It was also very confused because there were many, many little republics and free Soviets and libertarians, and there was the People's Republic of Ukraine and the People's Republic of West Ukraine, different ethnic groups, different political groups. The Cossacks tried to do their own thing. And then, of course, from the period 1918 to 1921, that independence got snuffed out because the Russians, the Bolsheviks and the White Russians, had a civil war that the United States intervened in, interestingly enough. But that's the subject
that's
another of another discussion.
Yes.
But that the Red Army and the White Army were fighting in through the 20s. And by 1922, the Red Army basically took the field, and I'm making the linguistic mistake. It's now Ukraine. It's no longer the Ukraine. The Red Army took the field and integrated Ukraine into the Soviet Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
Now that we're in the Stalinist era, you can't help but say something about collectivization. It must have been a terror. And did it come down heavily, Stalin's policy of insisting, demanding, forcing collective farms? Did that not have a great impact on the memory of the Ukrainians?
I'm sure there are family legends, and there may still be some alive who were children in the 1930s when all this occurred. The estimate is 6 to 8 million Ukrainians were killed by famine, and the rich agricultural lands of the Ukraine were collectivized into state-run farms. And I think I don't have the economic data, but the collective farms weren't as productive as the privately held.
Yeah.
Well, but Stalin actually used famine
as
a tool mm-hmm. of collectivization.
Yeah.
And those who paid the price were the 6 to 8 million that were killed.
Since Stalin, and especially most recently, I'd say 2014, there was a kind of an independence or a reform movement, so that slowly but surely Ukraine is trying to become an established, well-established, independent, democratic nation.
Well, that actually started in 1991 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Ukraine became an independent country at that point. For the next 9 to 10 years, it went through substantial economic dislocation, trying to move from a command economy into a more modern economy. Poverty increased. Productivity fell dramatically. But they started to turn that around in 2000 and actually made some good progress up until, 2006, there was a big dust up with the Russians where they cut off the natural gas supply, which was very important to Ukrainian industry. And by the way, we haven't talked about the Ukrainian steel and minerals industry. Iron, steel are a big deal in Ukraine, and mineral extraction is also. There are commercial quantities of some 90 minerals. It's a big source of titanium, which is very important for the aerospace industry and the aircraft industry. And they actually build and launch their own spacecraft in Ukraine. And the Antonov aircraft that's famous throughout Russia and everybody is a Ukrainian product.
We're talking to Mr. Dennis Carter, who is a retired Foreign Service officer who served for 38 years and visited 40 countries in his career after his graduation from Penn State University in 1974. We're talking about Ukraine and why Ukraine is important to the United States. This is the Seminary Explorers, and I'm pleased to be with you. I'm your host, Jerry Christensen. Nowadays, what would you think then is the basis of what, and I don't know if that's a word for it in the State Department, the vision that the U.S. has for Ukraine, or the prospects for relationship? Obviously, the one thing is it's on the border with Russia, but it also has major economic resources that we would be interested. Have they joined NATO?
No, not. I think their intention and their desire is to do so. And there are a couple of preliminary protocols in place to explore that, as well as to explore membership with the European Union.
And excuse me, Dennis, would the latter be more important to them right now? NATO, of course, is always a fraught question with the Russians. Putting a NATO ally right on their border would cause a little bit of nervousness.
I think the primary concern and goal of the Ukrainian government is to accede to the European Union. They're taking many regulatory steps to come into conformity with European Union rules. Many countries do that so that it facilitates trade. The Israelis are a good example. Everybody wants to build their product to European Union standards. And even if they don't join the European Union, that's a good thing because of proximity. The United States' interest is to support the development of a secure, democratic, prosperous, and free Ukraine fully integrated into the Euro-Atlantic community. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know that the United States can come out and say, oh yeah, we support integration into the European Union. That's for the European Union and the Ukrainians to decide. But it's the freedom of that choice that we want to be sure is on the menu for the Ukrainians. And
In the meantime, this is not necessarily the view of the Russians, and so there have been conflicts and continue to be conflicts, physical conflicts, over, let's start with Ukraine, and then there's the current problem with the Donbas.
Well, let's start with Ukraine. Ukraine has been the objective goal of the Russian Empire for as long as there's been a Russian Empire. Mr. Putin, of course, has made the comment that the dissolution of the Soviet Union was the biggest catastrophe of the 20th century. And he advances, when they get to international fora, he advances the idea that the Russians have a strong interest in what they refer to as the near abroad. And of course, Ukraine falls right into their definition of the near abroad. So they exert as much economic, political, and political influence as they possibly can. And now they are exerting military intervention in places like Ukraine and Donbas.
If you look at the map, you can see that Crimea has always been a kind of interesting, geographically, appendage into the Black Sea, and it's a little difficult for any of us to say, we're going to put up a fight over the Crimea. It would be difficult to defend. But incursions into what we have claimed to be in recent years, Ukrainian territory, was that included in this conflict over Donbas?
Well, those are the oblasts in the east of Ukraine that are actually occupied by Russian militias. It's important to note that the ethnic makeup as you move to the southeast in Ukraine, is more and more Russian. The ethnic makeup of the country is about 78% Ukrainian and 17% Russian. And that's concentrated more in the east of the country and toward the south. Ukraine, their industrial heartland, it's an industrialized society, but their real industrial heartland, the Pittsburgh of Ukraine, mm-hmm. would be Donetsk in the oblast to the east, up against, well, I think it's the Dnieper River.
What is our future then with Ukraine? What we tend to call lethal aid, that is military aid that is specifically tied to weapons that are anti-tank, missiles and so on. Are we engaged in that now, and what about the future?
Our interest is to promote a secure, free, independent, and democratic Ukraine. To the extent that their territory is not, occupied by foreign powers, the United States has an interest in making sure that the borders that are agreed as part of post-World War II settlements are adhered to, and the Russians are clearly violating Ukrainian borders now. Of our economic aid to the Ukrainians, about three-quarters of the aid package that the United States provides is economic aid in a whole variety of areas. And about one-quarter of that today is lethal aid. Now, that's a change that the current administration has made sure the Ukrainians are getting literally lethal aid in the form of anti-tank missiles.
There is an important insight that I have to learn at this moment. While we're thinking about the current administration appears to have left them out, hang them out to dry over political reasons. I don't know if that's true or not, but the picture is that in order to get something, the current administration asked for something. Whether it's true or not is still being determined. But meanwhile, you're saying that, in fact, on the military aids, that they have furnished some things that even the Obama administration did not furnish.
Oh, that's correct. It's been this administration that's provided Javelin anti-tank missiles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's making a difference. There's going to be a meeting in Normandy, I think coming up on December the 9th, between France, Germany, Russia, Ukraine, and I believe the United States is in on that, to work toward some sort of a disengagement. President Zelensky in Ukraine has made some hard decisions to move toward disengagement, and I think that's important. And he has the support of the United States in doing that.
Well, let's hope the Russians will go along, but I'm to play a little real politic here. Realpolitik, real politics. Is the situation changed because now the Ukrainians have the Javelin missiles? They've got muscle on their side.
I think
compared to the before they were just militias fighting one another, the Ukrainians didn't have much to stand up against the Russian incursion.
Well, there are a couple of factors here. The Russians are paying a price after the 2014 incursion into Donbas and Crimea. They were kicked out of the G8, which is why it's the G7 now. Economic sanctions have been put on, so the Russians continue to pay a price. The goal of every diplomat is to come up with some solution that allows both sides to declare victory mm-hmm. and go home. So to the extent that the Russians and the Ukrainians can come up with a formulation that allows each side to save face and declare victory, let's see what comes out of Normandy in the next week. But I think the signs are more positive than negative.
By the time you hear the show, that that conference will probably have been over. So please check your newspaper and listen to your television and radio. I don't want us to leave, Dennis, without your commenting. You notice, everyone will notice, I hope, that we stayed away from the current discussion about the role of Ukraine in American politics. And you've done a very good job of that. Congratulations. But do you have any comment whatsoever on the State Department role in current affairs, in American politics in particular? That you're willing to share?
I think we all have to be careful in public fora to base our discussions on fact. The only comment I'll make on my State Department and Foreign Service colleagues is that in recent public meetings, they have acquitted themselves professionally and well, and I appreciate the opportunity to offer that.
Dennis Carter is our guest today with a view of Ukraine, why it's important to us in the United States and to all democracies around the world. He's a retired Foreign Service officer with 38 years of experience. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers. Have a very good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explorers, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.